Paul said, if after the manner of men I have fought with beasts, were it being wild beasts at Ephesus. And that expression, if after the manner of man, is equivalent to so to speak. And it looks as if it was a common expression to fight with beasts. An allusion, of course, to the theatre and to the circuses, where men were thrown to the beasts, at least Christians were, but in after days, but men actually fought them. People were prepared and trained to fight them. So that when he says, if after the manner of men I fought with beasts, that is, so to speak, I fought with beasts, they were actually beasts at Ephesus. We have an allusion to the uproar in Ephesus in chapter 19. But after that had ceased, we don't know how long after, but it wouldn't be too long after, I think. After the uproar was ceased, Paul called unto him the disciples. He didn't want to endanger them more than was necessary. And doubtless when he called them together, he gave them plenty of instructions. And we read that he embraced them. I want you to notice, just in this passage that we read together today, something of the affection that the Christians had for one another. And he embraced them and departed for to go into Macedonia. Now, can I just remind you on the map? I probably will need to do that twice tonight. Macedonia is the northern part of Greece that has Philippi. So Paul was down there at Ephesus, and he's going to go up here into Macedonia, and then down into Greece. Okay, that's what's happening. And he's going by land. Possibly you can have a look at the maps when you get home. Paul embraced them and departed for to go into Macedonia. That's back to Philippi, especially Neapolis as well, and Thessaloniki and Berea. And when he had gone over those parts and had given them much exhortation, he came into Greece. In other words, he went, and he went to all the believing communities, and he encouraged them, had given them much exhortation each. He then went right the way down to Greece. And he stayed there 3 months, no doubt moving about, perhaps Athens, and then down to Corinth. And then afterwards, we're told, as he was about to sail into Syria, that's back towards Jerusalem and to the seacoast near Jerusalem. As he was about to do that, and when the Jews laid wait for him as he was about to sail into Syria, he purposed to return through Macedonia. Now, even in gospel matters, the Lord overrules a man like an apostle. And he does it for our advantage. Doubtless Paul could have been instructed in some other way. But you see, here his plan is turned by a providence that was unexpected in a way. But the Jews laid in wait for him, not for the first time. And he got to hear of it. And he realized that he would not be able to get down safely to the seaside and take a boat. So his plans are altered. But under the guidance and superintendence of the Lord, and he decides he's going to go back on foot, all the 200 miles odd he'd came, back up through Berea, and back up through Thessaloniki, and back up through Philippi, and round back the way he came to Troas. So we ourselves, whether it be as a church in gospel work, or whether it be in gospel work or in our own private lives, need to be alert to the providences of the Lord not to kick over the traces concerning them when they frustrate the plans that we think we have. Even an apostle needed to be alert to this particular guidance. Now, the end was going to be the same. He was still going to go to Jerusalem, but the route he was going to take, the people he would meet en route and so on, all these things now were to be different because the Lord had so arranged it. And it's just good for us to note when these providences occur in Scripture that we are subject to them too. And though we may have a plan, though we may have an idea what we want to do and to achieve it, and it may very well be laudable, the Lord, who knows all things and he knows whom we may affect, he knows the dangers in wait, he orders it otherwise. And it's good for us not to be frustrated by these things. So, we read that when the Jews laid wait for him as he was about to sail into Syria, he purposed to return through Macedonia. And there accompanied him into Asia Sopater of Berea. That's the first, not the first place he would come to, but the first place of which we know that was a fellowship. It's about, I'm speaking from memory now, I have been there 40 miles south of Thessalonica. And then Aristarchus and Secundus from Thessalonica. It's difficult to tell from the reading whether these people, whether Sopater dropped off at Berea and Aristarchus and Secundus dropped off in Thessalonica. It says they accompanied him into Asia, implying that they all went all the way. But that may not be what the language means. It may be they accompanied him en route to Asia. You see, that would make equally good sense. Sopater of Berea and Aristarchus and Secundus, and Gaius and Timotheus of Derbe in the region round about there, which is beyond Troas, and of Asia, Tychicus and Trophimus. And these going before tarried for us at Troas. That's Troy. Now, another little look at the map, you see. They went on ahead, and they went to Philippi, and then the ones went on to Troas, and then afterwards Luke, together with Paul, sets out for Troy or Troas also. So that's how it goes there. So they went before and tarried for us at Troas. It doesn't say whether they went by land, but certainly Luke, we sailed away from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread. And do you remember reading on, just at verse 16, that he wanted to be in Jerusalem at Pentecost? So we're thinking of the 7 weeks, the 49, 50 days, by which time he wanted to be there. So he has that in mind. It was his original intention. He still thinks that he wants to do that. So they came to Troas in 5 days, and they stayed there 7 days. And upon the first day of the week, when the disciples came together to break bread. Now, where you get the expression to break bread, it is shorthand for communion, that is, bread and the wine. Now, the Roman Catholics, I'm sure, greatly err, inasmuch as they used only, I don't know what they do now, to give to the laity the bread only. They didn't allow them, in days past, to take the wine. I don't know what they do now. But just because the expression breaking bread is used, it means the whole of what the Lord Jesus provided, of the bread and of the wine. So we see here the first day of the week. It presumably was almost at the end of the week. It looks as if they left, that they must have arrived probably on the Monday, and because he's ready to go the following Monday, and we know they stayed 7 days, and they gathered together on this first day of the week. Now, I'm not sure whether this gathering was a special gathering because Paul was there, or whether it was the normal Lord's Day gathering, or whether, to put it another way, it was, as always, the Lord's Day when they assembled, but there was a larger number there, and the people who travelled with Paul also had were there and perhaps had gathered others. Perhaps there were more than usual. It seems that on the Lord's Day they did gather together, because Paul in a certain place speaks about lay aside every Lord's Day as the Lord has prospered you. So it looks as if the Lord's Day would be a meeting for the people every week. But one wonders if this was because Paul's presence in some way a special occasion. And I say that because of the length of the meeting. Did they meet like this every time when they were up all night? You see? Paul preached unto them, ready to depart on the morrow, and continued his speech until midnight. Now, you wouldn't let me do that. And midnight was not even halfway through, because we're going to find out he actually preaches till it's dawn. And that's what makes me ask the question, was it because he was there and was soon to leave them? Or was this what they always did? See, in the society in which they lived, depending how secular it was, if it was not a Jewish gathering, then there would be no observance of the Sabbath day. And therefore, by that I simply mean that the Gentiles, the pagans, worked 7 days a week. They did have holidays, but they weren't at the end of the week. They were whenever there was the circuses, or whenever there was the special days. But they didn't have, like the Jews, a Sabbath day, or like the Christians, a Lord's Day. And so it was, you see, that slaves, even ordinary work people, could not get time off, and they worked long, long hours. And whether it was special or not, it seems as if every gathering of the Lord's people would have to commence after a long day's work. They might start at 6 in the morning or whenever, and finish at 6 and 7 at night, and then after that congregate to worship the Lord. And that might be like that every Lord's Day. So I am not sure, and I'm not sure whether we should think of this as being what happened every Lord's Day, or whether this was in some way particularly special because it was Paul and he was about to leave them. But clearly what is true is that they worked very hard. They worked very, very long hours. And their worship had to be, unless they were Jewish, that had to be sandwiched in between when they left work at night and went back to work the next day. And we read there were many lights in the upper chamber. Now, the sort of lights that they had in those days, the word that is used is torches, flambards. I'm sure there's a health and safety issue here. But they would use oxygen, that's the point I'm really making. And they were meeting 3 stories up. They were in an upper room of somebody's house. Now, we don't know, and we're not told, how high the roof was in each case. But I guess that when Eutychus fell, he would have fallen a minimum of 15 feet. It might well have been more, just depending. But there were 3 on the third floor, or on the second floor, if you say ground floor, first floor, second floor, but there were 3 lots up where they met. There were many lights in the upper chamber where they were gathered together. So it was well lit with flickering flames, and with the using of the oxygen. It was a nice gathering, you can imagine. Don't know how many were there. Might have been 100, but one doesn't know how squashed it was. One imagined it was squashed because Eutychus sat on a windowsill. Oh, don't think there was a sill as we would know it, but he sat in a window. Maybe he sat there deliberately so that he could get a bit more air. And maybe it was the only place where he could find room to sit anyway. But I want us just to think for a moment or two about Eutychus. Now, I chose the first hymn about youth, and the one to come is about youth. And I want you to see just a little something here about how the early church loved its young people. Now, the children followed Jesus, didn't they? And they were there shouting Hosanna when Jesus was brought into Jerusalem. And there's every reason to think they were believing children, having been instructed by believing parents. Eutychus is described here twice as a young man. But the word young man is used the first time in the Greek, but not the second time. Now, the word in Greek for a young man is made up of two words. And it's really much the same, but it's a new man, and it means a man who, a boy who has newly come to manhood. And it would probably cover the ages 15 to 20, that is the usual sort of thought, 14 to 20, 15 to 20. But that is the meaning of the word neonios, it's a new man, not born again type man, but newly come to manhood. But though the word is translated as young man, again, in verse 12, the word is child, Pais. Now, we get from Pais, pedagogy, a person who leads a child or teaches a child, and all sorts of word, but it is the word, the usual word for child. And if it's prefixed with a masculine word for the, it's a boy, and if it's got the female word, then it's a girl. But it's child, whether boy or girl. Now, how can a young man also be a child or a boy? I'm going to suggest to you, I cannot prove it, but I want to suggest to you that what we have here is a young man who is a slave. Now, you're probably aware that in the Caribbean, for example, in days gone by when there was a slave trade, they would refer even to a grown-up slave as boy. And that was usual, I think, wherever throughout the world you've got slaves dealing with even young men, it would be the boy around the house, the boy who did this. And it was referring to a man of 40, 50, 60. And that expression was used. And I think here that the word price, child, is used here in that sense of the word. The boy in the sense of a slave. So I think you've got a young man here of 16, thereabouts, who is a slave. If he's not a slave, then I think you then have to say that he's just a young man, you know, 14. You could equally well say he was a boy or a young man. But I'm inclined to the other view, that here we have a slave. Now, a slave would not be allowed of that age to be present at a gathering if his master wasn't there. So probably here we've got a situation, as you know, that Christians did have slaves, you know, because they were told to, how to deal with their servants, and servants were told how to deal with their masters. I would think here, you've got a servant or a slave of a Christian master. Possibly even, probably even, a Christian himself. His name, Eutychus, means fortunate. But that would be nothing to do with, there's no symbolic sense there, I'm quite sure. But he sat in a window, being fallen into a deep sleep. There's nothing new. And as Paul was long preaching, there's nothing new, he sunk down with sleep. And he fell down from the third loft and was taken up there. Now you see, if you've got these flickering lights, and if you've got a lack of oxygen, if you've got a boy who's been working from 6 until 6 and it's now 8:30 or 9, he's going to be pretty weary, with the best of intentions. But there is a place for such to sleep in church, it would seem. So, here you have him and he falls from level 3 and was taken up dead. And again, it's quite emphatic. He wasn't taken up dying. The word for dying and death is not used. The word for a corpse is the word that is used, necros. He was taken up a corpse. So you've not got a lad, if you like, been involved in an accident who's still just stirring, still just about alive. By the time they get down to him, he's quite dead. Now, inasmuch as death is the separation of the body from the soul, and according to the knowledge of God and the purposes of God, the soul may have gone to glory instantly, or may still be just about there. You know, that's not something that we can understand or know anything about. But clearly when Paul went down, he could see that he was dead, and he fell on him and embraced him. And the life came back, his soul came back into the body. And he said, "Trouble not yourselves, for his life is in him." They had been troubled. Now, there aren't very many occasions in the Bible where the dead are raised to life. Elijah 1, Elisha 1, Jesus 3, Peter 1, and Paul 1. So here was a most remarkable providence in the life of this young man. I guess he would be forever grateful afterwards to the Lord for sparing his life. I guess it would have a tremendous effect upon him. But as always with the scripture, it's very much understated. It's a marvellous miracle. And they were not a little comforted, but nothing said about how Eutychus might have felt about it. But what I wanted you to understand is the affection. They were not a little comforted. The word is not the same as "not a little" in the previous chapter, which was gangrenous. The word used is a word that means you couldn't measure the comfort. The relief was palpable. And here clearly the Lord does a remarkable thing to gel the faith together, to gel the people together, to make them see again the power of the gospel and of the Lord of the gospel. But I want you to see the love. If this boy was a slave, the love that the church had for them, they were mightily, mightily comforted when he was all right. Now, that was not typical in the ancient world. A slave was worthless. Not much happened. Didn't really matter. But among the Christians, if it be he were a slave, there's great, great love of the church. Now, I was asked a question this week. It gives me chances to mention it, really. I don't know whether you know the answer. But Mr. Spinks, the teacher, didn't know why it was called Good Friday. Well, I knew the answer to that. But I didn't know why it was called Maundy Thursday. Does anyone know? I looked it up, but okay, you'll be interested. It arises from John 13:34, which is why I mentioned it. A new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another. And that follows the washing of the disciples' feet immediately before they went to Gethsemane, immediately before Jesus was arrested, on that Thursday night before he died on the Friday. A new commandment. The Latin for command is the word that gives us mandatory. Mandate. Commandment, in the middle of the word. And actually it's just a new, different way of pronouncing it, Maundy. As the word came down the years, it changed pronunciation a little and became Maundy. So it's the Thursday when Jesus gave the commandment to love one another. And when the monarch gives out the money, he's saying, I, as head of the Church of England, I love my people. I mean, that is the significance. But I'm asking you to see here was a local church that did love. Paul embraced the young man. Well, that's fine, because he, you know, rather like Elijah, he put his arms around him to love. But he'd already embraced. We read at the beginning of the chapter that he embraced the disciples in Ephesus before he left. There was a real strong sense of loving one another in the Lord. This new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another, that he said to the disciples the day before he died. And here you see it in action. See the great concern that Paul has for the church. You'll see it later in the chapter when he goes to Miletus and the Ephesians come to him, but you see it here too with their attitude to this young man. After all that, Paul carries on where he left off. He goes upstairs again. They hadn't actually at that time taken communion, so they broke bread and ate, and then they talked a long while. Very interesting. It says in verse 9, he was a long time preaching. But the word is different in verse 11. They talked a long while. It's the word that gives us homily. And the suggestion here is that this was Christian talk, but not formal preaching. It might have been exhortation. It might have been even more general. But till the break of day. And so he departed. So Paul didn't get any sleep that night. And neither did any of the Christians get any sleep that night. Before they went back to work and Paul to his journey the next day. And if you'll allow me just in a few moments just to move you on so that we get to verse 17, which is where I'd like to take on in a fortnight's time. Next week, remember, is Jack Ants. God willing. We went before to ship and sailed unto Assos, where we would pick him up, for again Paul had decided to go by land. I don't think it was because he got seasick, he was often on a journey. I think he wanted to make contact with people as he went by. But if you can see on the map, Troy is there, Troas, and the sailing would go round the promontory, but Paul by road would be able just to go across to Assos there. And then the record then takes us south, sailing south, past the island of Chios, landing on the island of Samos at Troiglium, and then to Miletus, which is quite a little way from Ephesus, really, but it was from Miletus that he sent for the elders at Ephesus. So it's just a little journey down there. Don't know that the details matter too much, but I just wanted to read it to you in order that we can continue from verse 17 next time. So Paul here, this time, he says, we went before to ship, we sailed to Assos, there intending to take in Paul, for so he had appointed, minding himself to go afoot, you see. And when he met with us at Assos, we took him in, that's on the boat, and came to Mytilene, and we sailed from Mytilene, came the next day over against the island of Chios, that means they sailed by it opposite. The next day we arrived at Samos, that's another island, and tarried at Trogyllium, which I think is a place on Samos. And the next day we came to Miletus. For Paul had determined to sail by Ephesus, because he would not spend the time in Asia, for he hasted, if it were possible for him, to be at Jerusalem the day of Pentecost. Well, we'll leave it there, but I wanted you to think especially about the love which the church had for each other, and particularly for a young man whom we can take to be representative, about how they felt about all their young Christians and those who were part and parcel of the family of the church, whether they were servants or whether they were born into their families.